Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, I speak to actresses Amanda Seyfried and Lily Collins about their roles in the new Citizen Kane-inspired movie Mank, Mark Ryle on the week's new releases, and Olympian David Gillick on his favourite movie. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5pm on newstalk.com, the News Talk app, or wherever you choose to get your podcast, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6pm right here on News Talk. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. Good weekend to you all. Hope you're doing well in the ever-changing world of easing restrictions and all that kind of stuff. Luke O'Neill, a former guest on this show 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, who knows? Time is running away from us. But I heard him say this week on this station that we're in the end game with this virus, which made me very hopeful. So I hope you're feeling slightly hopeful. Now, I was watching this week.
Welcome to the North Pole.
Santa!
Kate Pierce. How did you get here? You and Jack are supposed to be on vacation with your family.
Our shuttle fell into this wormhole.
Have a nice trip.
Are you Mrs. Claus?
Uh-huh.
Ah! What is that thing?
Here's an F.
You're in Santa's village. The real one.
Wow, this is incredible.
We have over 300,000 shops in the village.
Everyone designed by Mrs. Claus.
She designed this place. I think it should be called Mrs. Claus's Village.
Me too.
Well, I never thought of that.
Of course you didn't.
Now, that is a clip from The Christmas Chronicles 2. Now, The Christmas Chronicles, the first one, without any digits on it, came out in 2018. It was this great Christmas movie with Kurt Russell playing a blinder as Santa Claus with these two teenagers who kind of spy Santa one night and then end up helping him deliver presents. And it was a great Christmas movie, kind of an old-fashioned Christmas movie in a way, a nice, simple story. I was really hopeful for Chronicles 2, Christmas Chronicles 2, and it's just not cutting the mustard, I'm afraid. Kurt Russell is back, and his wife or his partner in real life, Goldie Hawn, is also back playing Mrs. Claus. We're both really good in it. It's in Santa's village in the North Pole. But the story this time is just too convoluted. It's about this bad elf who tries to ruin Christmas, and there's a Star of Bethlehem vibe, and it just didn't hang together. I said earlier in the week on The Hard Shoulder that my son, who's clearly hanging around with me too much, gave it 2.5 stars, and he loved the first one. So I'm sorry to report Christmas Chronicles 2, not so good on Netflix. That said, you may not have seen The Christmas Chronicles, which is a lovely Christmas movie. So why not watch that this weekend? You will enjoy it. Now, I want to give a big shout out to the Irish language film Arrakt, which has been chosen by IFTA as Ireland's Oscar contender for Best International Film. Now, that doesn't mean it's necessarily going to be, you know, nominated for an Oscar. It's not going to be in the top five positions because it has to be whittled down. But it may be. But it's Ireland's entry for Best International Film. It's a gorgeous movie. It looks beautiful. It's set kind of just before the famine. It's filmed out in the West. It looks like, I don't know, Andrei Tarkovsky came to Connemara. I hope that's not too pretentious an analogy, but it's lovely. And it's dark, and it's a great watch as well. But what stayed with me was how beautifully shot it was, how glorious it looks. It really does. It's a lesson in cinematography and cinema making generally. And so we got to say a big congratulations to Tom Sullivan, who wrote and directed it. So let's hope it does make it to the final five. Let's hope it wins an Oscar. Now, big reaction last week to Amy Adams, who was on with Glenn Close talking about the role in Hillbilly Elegy. Mark Ryle will be giving us his view on that later on. And people loved what she had to say about the Aran Islands, which I brought up to her because it's a place very close to my heart. It made the papers. She was talking about bringing her daughter, if she could, back to the Aran Islands. Bord Fáilte even retweeted it. So, you know, you never know where an interview is going to end up. So it was lovely to talk to the two of them. And people seemed to enjoy the interview. People also seemed to enjoy the interview that I carried with Stephen Benedict, the filmmaker and film lecturer, all about Goodfellas turning 30. People love that movie. Someone did text in, and you can text this show when it's on the radio, 53106. They are read. Sean and Tralee asked us not to give away the ending. Sean, I'm sorry if a movie's 30 years old, there's going to be a bit of ending giving way. I'm sorry, it's the nature of the fast-paced world we lived in. Then we got a text from someone. They didn't leave their name. You'll probably see why in a second. Stephen had said that it was kind of a way of looking at Goodfellas was a critique of masculinity and maleness. We got this text in. You are wrong. Those movies are critiques of capitalism, not maleness, which is great. That's in brackets. That's according to Scorsese himself. Not you two middle-class emasculated wimps. You know me so well. I don't know who you are, but you have nailed me in two simple adjectives and a noun. Middle-class. Absolutely. I am buying goat cheese like it's going out of style. Emasculated, no question. And a wimp, 100%. I haven't had a fight since I was 7. So thank you very much for that. I can't speak for Stephen. He's a big, muscly dude who won't have goat cheese in the house. But you certainly nailed me. But if you want to get in touch with me, please do so. Screentime@newstalk.com is the email address. Or I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy. Now take a listen to this.
Meg, it's Orson Welles.
Of course it is.
I think it's time we talked.
What is it the writer says? Tell the story you know.
Hello, everyone.
Make yourself to home, Mr. Mankiewicz, or shall I call you Herman?
Please, call me Mank.
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 This is Herman Mankiewicz, but we're to call him Mank.
Mankiewicz. Herman Mankiewicz, New York playwright and drama critic.
Turned humble screenwriter, Mr. Hearst.
This is a business where the buyer gets nothing for his money but a memory. What he bought still belongs to the man who sold it. That's the real magic of the movies.
Thunder, lightning, blood, fire, religion.
Help! Someone save me!
All in one film.
That's director proof.
That's why I always want Mank around.
Yes, now that was a clip from the new movie Mank, which is launching on Netflix next week. Mank is all about the screenwriter Herman J. Mankiewicz, who was this hard-drinking, very quick-witted screenwriter. And in this, he's played by Gary Oldman. And Mankiewicz wrote Citizen Kane. There was a lot of debate about how much Orson Welles wrote. Mankiewicz wrote most of it. And this movie is all about Mankiewicz and the struggles he had writing Citizen Kane. And Gary Oldman plays Mank, and he's brilliant in it. And it's kind of a movie about that time in Hollywood, 1930s. Now, it also stars Amanda Seyfried and Lily Collins. Amanda Seyfried plays Marion Davis. Now, Marion Davis was this actress from the 30s who was the wife of William Hearst, the media baron, that newspaper guy, that it was rumoured, and it's pretty obvious, that Citizen Kane, the character in that, Foster Kane, was meant to be. And Marion Davis's character was also thought to be Susan Alexander in Citizen Kane. And in Mank, you have Amanda Seyfried playing Marion Davis, rubbing up against Gary Oldman's character, Mank. It is a great movie. I got to speak to Amanda Seyfried earlier in the week. So the movie's great, and it felt real classic Hollywood, and you looked like a 1930 starlet. And I know it's Marion Davis, but I was even thinking at times you looked a bit like Mae West. And I mean that as a compliment. Was it fun to kind of inhabit that long forgotten world as an actress?
I mean, it was a little bit intimidating and challenging, but I was surprised at how much fun I was able to have, even though I was so intimidated. But yeah, no, it was amazing. I've never stepped back that far in any, well, yes, I have. Les Mis, but
yes.
The golden age of Hollywood, that's a very specific era. And I grew up watching these movies because my dad's just such a fan of black and white movies. And it was so fun. It just transforming every day into Marion Davies was quite a ride.
Yeah. I can imagine. And did that take long in the makeup chair or?
Oh yeah, it took about 2.5 hours.
Wow, every day.
Every day, but that's okay because, you know, people would come in and out. Charles would come in and out real quick and Gary would come in and out real quick. And I'd have my coffee and I'd have time to really get ready for the day. It's kind of, I didn't realize how much I needed that. A little buffer from home to set. You get a space of time to really get your head in it, which I needed.
Yeah. And did you decide to rewatch Citizen Kane before you started this, just for some background? Because it's a long movie.
Yeah, no. Well, yeah, but I no. I in fact printed out the manuscript because there is a scene. I didn't listen. Citizen Kane. I have seen it. It's a beautiful. It's a masterpiece. There, you know, everybody should see it. But I didn't think it was necessary to refresh myself, especially because I, you know, I'm a little worried that I would absorb something about Susan Alexander that I didn't need to.
Yeah.
And I like to be safe about that stuff. And you know, this is the backstage. This is the backstage.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's not really that important. Person.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you and Gary Oldman, you really spark off each other. There's a lovely frisson between you. Do you work on that before you go on set? Like, did you spend a lot of time together working on that, or is it just the magic of what you're both able to do?
We absolutely, there was a very long dialogue, a lot of preparation with Fincher and Gary and myself, and you know, we work through the scenes and find moments and connections that were really essential for him to capture. But Gary and I have that as Gary and Amanda. We have a really great working relationship, and we also have that spark between us because he and I are pretty similar in a lot of ways in how we work, I think. And he's lovely. He's really incredibly fun to have on set because he doesn't take anything too seriously, but he works really hard and he's always 100% present. There's a mutual respect that you see underlying the whole thing.
Yeah. Finally, then, when I was 15, I was taken from Dublin to London to a Billy Joel concert. And it's been the mark of my life ever since. I claim to be Ireland's biggest Billy Joel fan, believe it or not. I swear to you. And I've brought him up in interviews with all sorts of people. And the only person I've ever met in my life from Allentown is you, albeit virtually. So I'm sorry to ask, but what did you make of that song? Or has it turned you against Billy Joel for the rest of your life?
No, I grew up on Billy Joel. That was just, Billy Joel was our everything to our family. I've seen him live in concert. I think I was on stage with him once.
Wow.
Was it? Yeah, I feel like I was on stage when We Didn't Start the Fire was playing. It was like, I think it was in Bethlehem. But I got to ask my mom because I need to clarify that memory. He's amazing. No, River of Dreams. Like, that's still one of my favorite songs of all time. No, he's, Allentown's great. I love it. The people know what Allentown is because of Billy Joel.
Okay.
I'm a huge Billy Joel fan, so thank you.
Well, thank you. And thanks a lot for talking to me. And Mank is great, by the way. Sorry to end with Billy Joel, but I had to ask, you know.
Yeah, anytime. I will talk about him all day.
Great. Next time. Right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That's Amanda Seyfried talking to me about Billy Joel, but also more importantly about her character playing Marion Davis in Mank, which is really good. Now, Lily Collins, she of Emily in Paris and also Phil Collins' daughter, plays Rita Alexander. She was kind of the secretary in Mankiewicz's life. Secretary, some people claim she was almost like a nurse to him, who was around when he was writing the script for Citizen Kane. Her husband was away in the war, and she kind of became a bigger part of his life. Even though she was there in a secretarial capacity, she kind of spurred him on, or certainly that's the way it's portrayed in this movie. Not a lot was known about her, but Mankiewicz went on to kind of loosely call the Marion Davis character after his secretary. She was Susan Alexander Kane in the movie. So anyway, Lily Collins. I got to talk to her as well during the week. Hi, Lily. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. I really enjoyed the movie. And I was thinking Rita's kind of almost like the moral center of it in a way. She really has Mank's back, and I know they have little arguments at times, but did you see her like that she was just an almost thoroughly decent character in a pretty corrupt Hollywood?
Yeah, I think that's part of why Mank opens up to her, because he feels that and he sees that. And I think it would be easy for her to not open her mouth and express herself because she's been hired, you know, to just sit next to him and help. Mm-hmm. But she genuinely feels this connection to Mankiewicz, and there is a love there and a respect and an admiration that makes her feel like she has to say something. She holds kind of this metaphorical mirror up to him and holds him accountable for things that honestly, I think, you know, he needs to be held accountable for, but no one else is seeing him in that vulnerable state like she is. And if she doesn't do it, who else will? And I think she sees the trajectory that he's going on emotionally and what he's going through, that if she doesn't say something, he may never deliver. And he's better than that, you know? And I think that she holds him to these standards that he would want to set for himself, but he's just not fully capable emotionally of doing that. And that's who she is, you know? And she also needs the support because she's mourning the loss of her husband that she thinks has died, and she's scared and alone. And he gives this kind of fatherly figure to her at a time when she needs it. So I love that their relationship is not romantic. You know, it's one that's filled with, like I said, love and respect and admiration, just platonically. And I think that it's really wonderful to see a relationship like that and how much they can both give to one another.
I was reading a small bit about her, now not extensively, I'm sure you know.
No, there's not much. No, there's really not that much that you can.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, because I didn't want to get anything wrong before I spoke to you. But there's not a huge amount about her. Like, at first, I wasn't even sure if she existed, but she clearly did. Yeah. But in some places, she's described as a nurse. In other places, she's a secretary. Was she, in essence, just his right-hand woman during this phase of his life, is probably the easiest way to say.
Yeah, I mean, there was a nurse, you know, and then there was Rita. And I think Rita was hired to be his like stenographer and to translate his story onto the page, but she became so much more, and she became this friend and confidant and really kind of, in essence, like partner in crime when he was going through this period of his life. And she's a very important figure to the family because of what she helped him go through and helped nurture him to get to the end of writing the script and like empower him in a sense. But there really isn't that much to be found on her. There's maybe two photos I saw. So it was a mixture of what we saw and read, as well as, you know, what she stood for in the film and how she differed from like a Marion Davies. And then the creation of her character through hair, makeup, and wardrobe, as well as being in the scene with Gary and kind of what he gave to me and how I fed off of it and just that kind of relationship. But it really kind of was based on her moral compass and kind of thematically what she could give to Gary's character.
Yeah. And of course, you're acting. That's, as Laurence Olivier said, try acting. So you were doing that as well.
Exactly.
And was Citizen Kane, you know, I remember we did it in college. Was that something you had ever watched before you did this? Or was it, did it loom large in your cinema knowledge, or had you just heard about it, or did you rewatch it for this?
All of the above, actually. you kind of nailed it. I grew up in LA after I moved here from England, and I even visited Hearst Castle with my mom years ago and did a tour of it. And so I was very familiar with that part of the story. I've also done two other projects that are based in this period of Hollywood. So I felt like I've got a plethora of knowledge and research done already about the period. Had played Americans in those, but obviously bringing in the cultural differences from England. But the film was something that, well, not of course. I mean, I love old movies. So I grew up in a family that loved old movies, whether they were black and white or when they first started making color. I love old Hollywood movie stars, and I was obsessed with Hollywood when I moved here. And so, you know, I felt like that period of time has always been fascinating to me, but also there's kind of this familiarity with it because I grew up loving it. So it wasn't like I read the script and thought, oh, who's that? Who's that? I already was pretty clued in as to who these people were and what they were referencing. But of course, you want to just keep doing as much research and being open to what David's recommending and Gary. And, you know, you learn something new all the time. So I love being able to do research for a role, and especially something that I actually live in.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you nailed it. So well
done. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for talking to me.
Yeah, you as well. Take care.
Lily Collins there, who plays Rita Alexander in Mank, which is on Netflix from next Friday, and it is a very good movie. Now, finally, Tom Purperley, the actor, some of you will know, he played Ben Davis in Ozark, fine actor, plays Mankiewicz's brother. Now, you may not know, but Mankiewicz's brother was Joseph L. Mankiewicz, who was like a screenwriter and director and Oscar winner and all sorts of things. And the brother relationship in this movie is very important. He's Herman's brother. And I also got to talk to Tom during the week.
I was wondering, Joseph Mankiewicz, there's a lot about him. He won Oscars and did all sorts of things. There's probably a real temptation to almost over research when you're playing someone like that, because there's a lot of stuff about him out there. Did you do a lot, or did you just think, I'm going to inhabit this for myself and leave all that stuff alone?
Yeah, I mean, you do some research. In particular, it was really helpful, all of the videos of Joseph speaking. You know, he did a civil rights talk with Marlon Brando. He did, he was on game shows. I found videos of game shows back in those days, you know, which is really fascinating, like the more casual, kind of the more helpful. And then right before we started filming, a great biography came out about Herman and Joe, which was super helpful. But yeah, ultimately, you're right. Ultimately, in this script, it's sort of like, what is the essence of Joe that we want to shine through to serve our story the best? And to me, that boiled down to the younger brother who absolutely adores and looks up to his older brother.
Yeah, there's a gorgeous scene. I don't want to give a spoiler, but sure, anyway, not far from the end, where you're sitting out in this lovely vista and you kind of say to him, it's the best thing you've ever done. It's a beautiful moment in it, kind of. It's almost the emotional key point, or one of them, in the movie, you know?
Yeah, I thought when I read that scene that was so beautiful, that it was so spot on, in the sense of like these two brothers who are both so intelligent and so wonderful with words, you know, that at the end of the day, he's trying to talk him out of something, and when that can't happen, he's like, okay, I'm not happy about this, but I have to admit it.
Yeah.
It's the best. And like, ultimately, both of us know it. And ultimately, like, that's the coolest thing we can say, you know, like, this is the best thing you've ever done.
Yeah. I was saying to Amanda and then to Lily that they both worked great off Gary, you know, and then I was going to say the same to you. And I thought, well, that's overdoing it now. But then, I mean, I guess the constant is Gary Oldman. Like, he seems very easy to play against or play with. Not that you guys aren't great as well, but he just, I imagine he's an easy presence in terms of a set.
He's wonderful. You know, I've been a huge fan of Gary Oldman since I was pretty young. When I was 18 years old, I had a still frame from State of Grace with him and Sean Penn up on my door.
Wow.
I was in drama school. Yeah. So like, I have been a bit obsessed with Gary Oldman for a long time.
Did you tell him that?
I finally did. Because at first I was like, I have to respect this man's space. We're here to do a job. I don't want to weird him out or anything, you know? But I quickly realized, like, this guy, I was like, is he going to be weird? Is he going to be brooding? Is he going to be mysterious or temperamental? And he was the sweetest. He was so soft-spoken and kind, and with a wonderful sense of humor. And he was so happy to, you know, one of the first days of filming was the writer's room, and you have all these young actors and Gary Oldman, and we're like, tell us stories. And he's so happy to oblige us and so generous with his time. And, you know, it immediately made it super, super easy in a situation where I definitely could have been intimidated.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes meeting your heroes works out for the best, you know.
Yeah. Not always.
I, on my show, spoke to the great film critic David Thompson, and he had this great sentence or phrase where he said the best movie of 2020 so far was the last four episodes of the last season of Ozark, which was, I thought, was kind of a stunning thing to say. And this guy knows his movies, and his point being that, you know, some of the best stuff we're seeing on screen is on cinema, or sorry, is on what we would call traditionally television. Like, I'm just wondering, I'm sure you were delighted to be a part of Ozark, another Netflix production as well, because people just adore that show.
Yeah. It was amazing. I mean, that's really a kind of dream job. I mean, last year was a good year. I did Mank and Ozark, but Ozark was one of those things where you're stepping into a show that I already loved as a fan. So you got the writing, you got the fact that people watch it, you got the fact that I love the tone it strikes. And then you walk into this role and it's like, are they really? Like, I get to be new to the show and play this role?
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like, that's not...
Yeah.
that's probably not something that's going to happen on every show. And so it was just the perfect storm. Every now and then they come around where it's the perfect storm. And I was in heaven filming it.
Right. Know? Well, look, I'm sure there's many more great roles ahead of you. As you say, you're a young man yet. So thanks a lot for talking to me.
Hey, thanks so much, John.
Tom Purpley there talking to me about his character, Joseph L. Mankiewicz, in the movie Mank. And Mank is well worth a watch. It's a very kind of movie about a movie, but in a good way. I really enjoyed it. And Gary Oldman is great in it, as is Lily Collins and Amanda Seyfried, who you heard me talking to there earlier. Up next, Mark Ryle and the new releases.
Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. It's that stage of the week where we look at the week's new releases. And the big new release of the week is Hillbilly Elegy, which I think it's fair to say is getting a pounding by a lot of the critics. It was released on Netflix this week, unusually on a Tuesday. I spoke to its two leads, of course, last week, Amy Adams and Glenn Close, but that doesn't really matter. And we'll also be looking at David Cronenberg's son's second movie, that's Brandon Cronenberg, Possessor. And to do all this, I am joined by the multi-talented Mark Ryle. How are you, Mark?
The barely talented Mark Ryle.
Come. So listen, Hillbilly Elegy, it's kind of been torn apart by the critics. I'm not quite sure why. We'll get to what I thought about it briefly in a while, but maybe tell us what's going on in Hillbilly Elegy, which is now available on Netflix.
Let me explain why it's being torn apart by the critics. Yeah, are you familiar with the book? I have to say I've never read the book and it wasn't on my radar before. Did you know anything about this, the J.D. Vance book from 2016?
No, just when I went to interview the two leading ladies last week, I read up a bit out of it, and the book had been very popular. Kind of controversial, though, because some people felt it was a Trump apology almost. So it was, and even the name, I suppose, caused a bit of wavage, if that's a word. So I was vaguely aware. No, I wasn't aware of it at all, but then I read up on it.
Yeah, I guess so. Okay, so the story here is, it is about a kid, JD. He's from a small family of roughly 300 hillbillies from Kentucky. The adult JD is a successful law student at Yale. On the day before a very important job interview, he gets a call from his sister telling him that his mother has had an overdose. So he returns home to, I think it's Ohio, and he has 24 hours to ruminate on what has become of his family. I suppose the first problem is the character of JD, whether he shall turn out to be the hero of his own movie, or if that station shall be held by Glenn Close as a sort of redneck Yoda. there's far too much of JD in this and not enough of Glenn Close and Amy Adams. I really went into this with an open mind, and I gave it plenty of chances to win me over, but it wore me down. It's just relentlessly terrible, and everything is painted in big, broad strokes, and there's no subtlety. I don't know who wrote the screenplay, but I'd imagine they wrote it in crayon.
Now, hang on a second, just to explain for listeners as well, though, Amy Adams plays his mother, who is battling all kinds of demons, let's say. His grandmother's attempting to keep the family together. And I thought those two performances were great by Amy Adams and Glenn Close, though. Did you not?
I did not. There's an awful lot of wig and prop acting going on here. I have to say, Amy Adams is better than this. And I think she's marginalized at the expense of the character JD. Glenn Close, I think what's happened is that she has used the props and the wigs to build the character instead of finding the essence of the character first. And I really would have, what you get is a sort of a Disneyfied Requiem from a Dream. Requiem for a Dream, sorry. But instead of, you know, Ellen Burstyn getting electroconvulsive therapy, you have Amy Adams off her head roller skating around an IC unit. And Ron Howard has a reputation of being a safe pair of hands, and he deserves that reputation. Studios are very happy to hand him the keys because they know that he's not going to come back with something that's unpalatable and difficult to swallow, because that's not what he's interested in. He tends to take all the sharp edges out of a story, and what's left here is really as clean and as safe as an episode of Happy Days. But the sharp edges are often the best bits, and they are really what make a movie worth watching. But the sharp edges here have just been removed.
But did you not think there were sharp edges when, like, not to give a spoiler, but Amy Adams, as this kid's mother, you know, overdoses or, you know, is horrible to her kids and all that kind of stuff? I mean, that's pretty sharp.
Not enough. I didn't think there was enough Amy Adams. And as I said, she's kind of, she's just in the background. And the two characters who play JD, Gabriel Basso plays the older character, and Owen as Talos, I think, is the younger version. He's like, he's a Boy Scout and he's vanilla, and there's far too much attention in the story given to him at the expense of Amy Adams. I really would have loved to have watched this with an audience, because I think whatever tone Ron Howard was going for, he completely missed the mark. And I found myself laughing at some of the scenes of high drama, and then the bits that were supposed to be funny, I just found cringy.
I'm sure that's not what he was going for.
Perhaps he was. You never can tell. But no, I just found it wasn't gritty enough, and it was just dialed down and Disneyfied. It's a really shoddy movie, I have to say.
Well, let me retort slightly. I agree with you about the kid. And also the older actor, both of them playing JD. I thought they were kind of wallpapery and acting by numbers. But I disagree on the two central performances. I thought Glenn Close, as I said to her last week, she reminded me of like Northside Dublin grandmothers, that tough mother, grandmother who holds, you know, disparate families together. And I thought Amy Adams was great in it. And that got me over the line. So I watched it from start to finish without feeling bored. I did think maybe there was issues around painting rednecks and hillbillies and Appalachian Trail people as one broad brushstroke, which I didn't really work for me. But I thought the performances of the two central ladies got it over the line for me. And I actually think, and I don't know what you think about this, but I wouldn't be surprised, it got a cinema release in the States, if both of them are nominated for Oscars.
They're undoubtedly going to be nominated. I think they probably have an unofficial competition going for who can get the most Oscar nominations without actually winning. I think Glenn Close has 7 and Amy Adams is just behind with 6. But honestly, I don't think Adams has a hope of this. She's far better than the role. Glenn Close might end up winning something out of this. But as I said, I think there was a really interesting story Amy Adams' character, but it's kind of marginalized, and it just didn't work for me, I'm afraid.
Okay, well, we're in almost complete disagreement, which is good, you know. So what are you going to say stars-wise?
I'm going to give it a 2 just for Glenn Close.
Okay, well, I'm going to give it a 3 for Glenn Close and Amy Adams. There you go. Okay, well, that's Hillbilly Elegy, now available since Tuesday. I don't know why I find it so strange that it landed on a Tuesday. It just seems odd to me.
It's
Tuesday.
A strange world, John.
It is a strange world, Mark. Well said. You always had the great phrases. Now, tell me this. I'm intrigued by this because, you know, I'm meant to know a lot about cinema, but I didn't even know that David Cronenberg had a son called Brandon who makes movies. So I'm sorry for that. But he has a new movie out, his second feature, and it's called Possessor.
That's right. He had a movie a couple of years ago called Antiviral. I think the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. If you didn't know the familial connection going into this, you would still come out comparing it to, you know, quintessential Cronenbergs like Videodrome or Rabid. And I would imagine that family dinners at the Cronenbergs must be a hoot, because this is heavy stuff.
Wild affairs.
Yeah. Possessor is a body horror sci-fi. It's set in the present, and it's difficult to explain in a few lines, but I'll give it a go.
If any man can.
Somebody else. Andrea Riseborough plays an assassin called Tassia Voss, and she carries out her kills by having her mind implanted into the body of another person with access or a connection to the intended victim. This is all explained for us in a prologue segment where Voss brutally murders a businessman using somebody else's body. but there is a glitch in the matrix, and it becomes apparent that she is beginning to have trouble pulling out of these inceptions and returning to the real world. And this in turn affects her next job, where the target is Sean Bean, who must be one of the most killed actors on the planet.
That's what he says when he gets a script. On what page do I die?
Please don't kill me again. The high concept behind this is the idea of being able to weaponize people. But the tone isn't that of your bog standard action movie. And Cronenberg isn't particularly interested in the whys and the wherefores of the technology of how this is achieved. But instead, it goes down a slightly more cerebral route. And the tension is brought about through Risborough's wobbly mental state and her increasing inability to control these vessels that she's possessing, and the suggestion that her job has turned her into an unpredictable psychopath.
Okay. Intriguing enough stuff. Before you tell me if it's any good or not, is he making some comment on, you know, technology taking over humanity to some fashion, or is it just a straight ahead psychological horror?
It's a straight ahead psychological horror. There is there's this extraneous subplot about data mining that's really not needed, and it doesn't really go anywhere, but I don't think he's trying to make any big statement about technology and that. It is hyper violent, and there's very much why stab somebody once when stabbing them 47 times will do the job just as well. And it is very, very gory. So this should come with a health warning for the squeamish. And also the thing is that the given that Risborough is the lead, she's got very limited screen time because for most of the movie, she's inhabiting the body of another actor, Christopher Abbott. But she really does make an impression while she's there. It's strongly suggested that everything about in her life is a performance, right down to the way she pre-rehearses these mundane conversation with her husband and her child. It's very, very creepy and off-putting. If you are to believe the marketing and the pull quotes on the poster, and I have no reason to believe that the marketing people would ever exaggerate or lie, this supposedly is groundbreaking sci-fi, and it's one of the best films of the year. Now, of course, it's nothing of the sort, but it is a very solid science fiction, and it's an intriguing premise, and it's been well executed. And it's got a very sleek, modern look. But on the other hand, it's a very cold movie and it's quite difficult to engage with. I would say I wasn't underwhelmed by it, but at the same time, I wasn't particularly overwhelmed either. I guess I was just whelmed.
Yeah, that's a very Mark Ryle thing to say. I wasn't underwhelmed by it. It's a double negative. It's how I see you sometimes, you know. So put that one on the poster. So what would you say stars wise?
I'm going to give it a 3.
Okay. Fair enough. It sounds intriguing to me. It sounds cold, as you say, but intriguing. I'm going to say something very controversial here. David Cronenberg, I don't always get, to be honest. I mean, it's not that I don't understand the movies, but I find them hit and miss.
I agree,
some of
them
I thought were great, but other ones I'm just like, what the hell was that about? Why did I watch that, you know?
Yeah, so, I agree. You really have to be in the mood.
Yes, you do. I'm always in the mood for you, Mark.
we'll stop it there.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, John.
And Possessor is available on digital platforms, and Hillbilly Elegy, I should say, is also available on Netflix. I liked it. I mean, I didn't love it, but I definitely liked it, and I don't get why people are hating on it. So let me know, guys. Watch it if you haven't. I'd love to know what my loyal listeners who are in touch all week long think about it. John_Fardy or screentime@newstalk.com. Up next, David Gillick on his favourite movie.
Screen Time on News Talk.
Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. It's that stage of the week where we talk to someone well known about their favourite movie. David Gillick is one of Ireland's most successful athletes, a 2-time European champion, an Olympian and a world finalist. In recent years, he's also been known as somewhat of a foodie, having won Celebrity MasterChef, and he's also become something of a mental health advocate lately as well. More of that anon. He's here to chat about his favourite movie. And it's not Chariots of Fire. David, how are you?
Hey, Johnny. All right, thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. I should be thanking you. So your favourite movie, tell our listeners.
Yeah, I suppose when you asked me the question, I was like, straight away, a number of films came to the fore. But Gladiator for me was, and still is, one of my favourite films. I like, obviously coming from that kind of sporting background, you know, Russell Crowe in it is just, for me, he's immense, you know, and the whole kind of warrior, you know, in Rome, the Colosseum, everything about it is quite motivating. And I think that's the big thing that when I first watched it was like, you know, it's a long film, but you didn't really want it to end in a way. And I think I was asked the question, like, if my life was a movie, who would I like, which actor would I like to play me? And I was like, oh, Russell Crowe, you know, off the back of Gladiator, you know.
I said Woody Allen to that question once, so there you go. And you say he's immense, and, you know, Russell Crowe has, you know, he's been up and down in people's public perceptions, but I just think, as you say in this movie, it's a powerhouse of acting. Like, he's just incredible, and you can't take your eyes off him. And men and women say that about him. I know he's a deeply attractive man and all, but he's incredibly cool in it as well.
Very much so. And I know what you mean. Like, his perception has probably kind of altered numerous times over the last couple of years since that movie. But I think when it was released, you know, he was able to do the role, like, just immensely. He was phenomenal in it, and he was able to play that kind of big brute of a character, but yet the softer side to him with his family and his wife. And that was always to the core, you know. It was always, you know, his values was the family and trying to get back there and kind of chasing that. And one thing I kind of liked as well was, you know, when he was captured and he was brought away, and then he was very isolated, but then suddenly created a bit of a kind of a team around him, you know, that persona to bring people in and work together. And I suppose there's a few kind of hidden messages there, you know, in terms of even that I could relate to when I was competing. And I got to be honest, like, it was one of these movies I would throw on if I was traveling leading into a championship, and even the Olympics, it was on. We threw it on in our holding camp because it is that sort of inspirational, motivational type of movie.
Wow. Yeah, I was actually going to ask you that. Was that something you watched Mornings of Races? But it is, clearly.
Yeah, it is. And the team tune. The team tune for me was on the playlist. You know, it was, you know, the tune was quite motivating. But, you know, and I think as an athlete, you're always looking for those little things. Like, you know, another movie was like Braveheart. That was always something else that would kind of, you know, just get you firing a little bit. And I think, you know, athletes are always kind of looking for that sort of stuff. And the team tune to Gladiator was on the playlist because it was a nice kind of calming, but yet there was an undercurrent of kind of, right, we're ready to do battle here. Like, and that's the kind of mindset you had going into championships and races.
Wow, fascinating. And I made a joke about Chariots of Fire. Was that mildly inspiring to you ever, or was it just too old a movie?
No, it wasn't. I would have watched that. All athletes would have watched that, you know. And, like, there's other movies out there that's in the athletic world, like the story about Steve Prefontaine, you know, and it's those sort of Chariots of Fire-esque sort of movies. And, you know, even again, you talk about the theme tune to Chariots of Fire, like, that's something that I remember. When I was a little kid doing the community games, they'd bring it out to Morton Stadium, Santry, and everyone would do that kind of big parade at the very start of it. And the tune belting out of the old rickety tannoy was Chariots of Fire. So it was always a team tune that would kind of just motivate you and bring you back to that place. But even Chariots of Fire, the movie, is actually, it's good. You know,
it is
something you could still watch now, and kind of it's relatable in a way. And again, in terms of like athletics, like, there's not that many movies about athletics, but Chariots of Fire, everybody knows Chariots of Fire.
Mm. Yeah, no, it's a very good point. And Any Given Sunday, that famous Al Pacino speech, does that work for you? Yeah.
Yeah, Inches, Al Pacino, Inches was, I remember I first came across, you know, like, it was 07, I downloaded that segment, and I had it, and I still have it on my playlist. And I remember the guys I was living with, because I relocated over to England in 06. So again, it was like, right, now I'm really ready to up the ante and do everything I possibly could be to be the best athlete in the world. And, you know, we used to blare that out of the apartment. And one of my training partners, Graham Hedman, like, he was very into that sort of stuff as well. He must have had that on repeat the whole time. But, like, even the words, all about the Inches, control the controllables, it's, you know, it's that sort of stuff that would resonate with anyone who's kind of high performer, be it in the world of business or be it in sports, you know.
Yeah, I could keep going and start naming movies at you, but we won't. Gladiator is a wonderful choice. And interestingly enough, has never been chosen in this slot, which is nearly 2 years old at this stage. So, wonderful choice. This is obviously a movie and TV show. And I'm just wondering about the Celebrity MasterChef thing. You know, it was kind of a revelation how good you were with food and you won the thing. But it must be weird when you're, you know, competing like that and you're cutting up olives or whatever it was, to have cameras all around you. Was it a strange sensation to, like, I know you were obviously filmed when you were running and stuff like that, but this was like cameras in your face as you're worrying if, you know, the sorbet is going to work out and all that.
Yeah, like it was completely different and something I'd never really experienced. Like it was strange because I was actually injured that year, so I wasn't going to be able to compete. And then I was asked to do this and I said, yeah, look, I'll give it a go. And like, I can remember the first day going in thinking, what am I doing here? And like that was 7 years ago. That's just crazy thing.
Wow.
7 years ago. And I suppose here we are talking about it. So I continue to milk the backside out of it. But it was.
I did bring it up, though.
You did bring it up. So I blame you. But it was a great experience, I have to be honest. And I think the thrill I got from it was, I can remember first or second task, we were all kind of lined up outside of the kitchen. And you don't know what you're going to be asked to do. You know, we've all watched the show, so we kind of had an idea of the certain task, but we didn't know on that day. And that sense of, like, you know, anxiety, the nerves, it was like performing. It was like going out of that call room into the stadium, getting ready to set your blocks and run a race. And when you're positioned behind your kind of kitchen unit, you don't know what's coming. But strangely enough, you forgot about the cameras.
Okay.
You know, there was a bit of TV where you had to walk in and,
you
have to do that again. You know, you end up doing it three or four times, you know. But once they said go, you forgot about the cameras. And it was just, it was all about kind of, right, I need to do this, I need to do that. And then you're looking over, oh God, they're ahead of me, or you're falling behind, and then they're shouting. The one thing I would say, and like, because it was a celebrity version, I think people thought that we got an easy ride. We did not. Like, if it was an hour, it was an hour, and there was no extra minutes available. Like, they wanted you to crumble. They wanted you to mess up, because, let's be honest, that makes good TV.
Yeah.
But I think for me, it was, like, people said to me, oh, you're very methodical. And I was thinking, Jesus, I didn't even know I was. But when I was looking back, it was something that surprised me about myself, was that I had a process. You know, it was all about, okay, a process, a clear process. And I kind of just kept going through the stages of each task. And then, like, I managed to get through each day, you know. And then, lo and behold, I was announced the winner.
Yeah, sweat on your brow and all. Well done. Let me just ask you finally then. I mentioned, you know, in later years, you've become something of a mental health advocate. And I was thinking about this. You've been very honest about your own battles is a terrible word, but your own dealings with mental health issues, let's say. And at the same time, you were this very successful athlete. So I wonder, you know, and this is a weird way of looking at it maybe, but is it almost a perfect storm to be able to talk about it? Because here's a guy who's had his own problems, but at the same time competed at the top level and, you know, has Gladiator as his favorite movie. Do you know what I mean? In a way that you're ideally made to talk about these things, possibly.
Yeah, possibly, you know, and like, if, you know, now, like I'm comfortable talking about the journey, you know, and kind of coming through it and the highs and the lows. But there was probably, you know, the other side of it is, like, because I had got to a certain level in terms of athletics, you know, relatively successful, won a couple of medals, etc., that was the way I thought the rest of my life was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get to a certain level of success, so you have to be either maintain that or you want more. And if you don't, I deemed myself as a failure. And I think that was a huge part of mental health and, you know, not being comfortable in my own skin and, you know, worried about what people thought and trying to live up to that persona. I've been the macho man and been the alpha male and success and stronger, fitter, faster, all of that.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes, you know, the public persona is that that's what you are and you need to live up to that. So I think sometimes people get a bit surprised that for someone who has, you know, compete at a high level, et cetera, can label their feelings and be actually open and honest about the journey that, you know what, it's not all about success and it wasn't all plain sailing. And, you know, I'm actually human and I'm normal. Mm-hmm. And that's probably the feedback that I've got over the last couple of years, that people are actually surprised, like, oh, how open and honest I now am about the journey. And like, it is a little bit like that. I do think kind of you've used a good phrase there, like a kind of perfect storm, because the way I look at it is you kind of have a profile and you have an opportunity to try and help other people and make a difference. And I suppose me talking about mental health is trying to help other people, because that's what helped me. You know, I heard someone talk. I heard someone who competed at a really high level in terms of football. I heard them speak, and then I was like, oh my God, like this is me. This is resonating. Yeah. And that helped me, you know, get the help required and get me back on track. So I suppose it's very much like, you know, people are looking up to you. You have that sort of opportunity to kind of remove that stigma and hopefully help a few people out there.
Yeah, wonderful. And I should mention, your book is called Back on Track, one of your many books, because you've had some food books out as well. So that's available from good bookshops still, I'm assuming, right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's still like I've two books. And my first book was very much a cookbook off the back of Celebrity MasterChef. And then my second cookbook, I want to do a little bit more about the journey that I was on. So hence, I kind of broke it into like food, an element of fitness, mindset, and then rest recovery. So it is very much a cookbook, but the prior kind of chapters to the food element is very much about, like, you know, just trying to build food in as part of your overall well-being. So it's, yeah, look, it's gone pretty well. I don't know now if there's a third one in me. I have to say, maybe with the kids in my life, I'll have to do something for them or something, you know. But
Well, let's see. Well, Back on Track is available, makes a nice stocking filler. His favorite movie is Gladiator, and he doesn't mind Chariots of Fire either. David Gillick, thanks a million.
Thanks, sir. Thanks for having me on.
My name is Maximus Decimus Meridius, commander of the armies of the North, general of the Felix Legions, loyal servant to the true emperor, Marcus Aurelius, father to a murdered son, husband to a murdered wife, I will have my vengeance in this life or the next.
Yes, a clip there from Gladiator. And my thanks to the very nice David Gillick. I could have talked to him for a lot longer, and maybe I will again in the future. That's it for this week. My thanks to Anne-Marie Kane, who helped out on the show this week, as she does every week. And sometimes I forget to mention her. Shame on me. Next week, a man I've longed to talk to and never had, the great Colm Meaney, does a nice long interview with me. So I'm looking forward to bringing you that. I'll just remind you that this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com, the Newstalk app, or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on Newstalk. Leave you with some music from the movies. FM is a movie from the late 70s about a radio station. It's pretty crap, but it has this great classic song by Bob Seger on the soundtrack. So I will leave you with that and talk to you all next week.
I was a little too tall, could have used a few pounds. Tight pants, points, hollering out. She was a black-haired beauty with big dark eyes and points all her own, sitting way up high. Way up firm and high. The cornfields where the woods got heavy, out in the back seat of my 60 Chevy, working on mysteries without any clues, working on our night moves, trying to make some front page driving news, working on our night moves in the summertime. Some pie in the sky song. We were just young and restless and bored, living by the sword. And we'd steal away every chance we could, to the back room, to the alley, or the trusty woods. I used her, she used me, but neither one cared. We were getting our share, working on our night moves, trying to lose the awkward teenage blues, working on our nightmares. And it was summertime. Sweet summertime, summertime. Mm-hmm. of the lightning. Yeah, waiting on the thunder. Woke last night to the sound of thunder. How far off, I sat and wondered. Started humming a song from 1962. Ain't it funny how the night moves, when you just don't seem to have as much to lose. Strange how the night moves. With autumn closing in,